listeners, and welcome back to Hello Health Informatics, a podcast where we will explore projects by health informatics practitioners in Canada. I'm your host, Mira, and on today's episode, we will be talking to David Brown, a manager of clinical informatics at Providence Healthcare. For some background, David did his bachelor's degree in commerce at the University of British Columbia, also known as UBC, with a focus on information systems, and then later a master's in health administration at UBC. He currently works as the manager of clinical informatics at Providence Healthcare, where he manages a team of approximately 20 clinical informaticists. One hobby that David has recently gotten into is outrigger canoeing, which I'll honestly let him explain more now. Welcome to the podcast, David, and tell me more about this outrigging and where it originated from.
Thanks, Mary. Yeah, great to be here. Outrigger canoe is a water sport that originated in the Polynesian Islands, and you may have seen the boats. It's more common in areas that are close to sort of temperate water like Vancouver, Hawaii, New Zealand. And they're very small, skinny canoes with sort of an arm on the side called an alma. And they're meant for sort of more sort of wavy water canoeing than your standard river canoe.
How did you even, I guess, hear about outrigger canoeing? Because the first time you mentioned it, I was surprised. Taken away.
I started off in high school. We had a teacher that was passionate about it. And again, it's a fairly common sport in sort of like water neighboring cities like Vancouver, Victoria. Mm-hmm. A lot of people start off with dragon boat racing, which is a little bit more common and popular. Outrigger, I like to think of it as like marathon running, where dragon boating is like track and field events. It's a lot more long distance. It's a lot more endurance, but very similar in how you paddle.
And would you say there'd be like a team of people in an outrigger canoe, just like dragon boating?
Yeah, I think the most standard boats are usually a one-person boat, a two-person boat, or a six-person boat. I do a lot of six-person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. You're making me already feel this East Coast, West Coast difference in terms of, I think people in the BC would know what you're talking about straight away, whereas people in Ontario are probably a little confused like I am, or just not near water like you are.
Well, and not being in the water in February is probably a good idea in Ontario.
Yeah. But before I get too sidetracked, I guess I wanted to talk to you about why I asked you to come on today and speak about your clinical systems and transformation project. I know you were involved in a while ago. It's definitely not a recent project. And just give me some more information about how did this project like originate? What was the need for it? Where did it come from? And all the details, all the good details behind that.
Yeah. So the Clinical Systems and Transformation Project, which I'll refer to as CST more often than not, was or continues to be a massive project in the Lower Mainland in BC, which is kind of like Vancouver, Greater Vancouver area. And what they were trying to do was bring multiple health organizations and health authorities onto the same system. So this wasn't just about rolling it out in one organization, but actually three collaboratively engaging in the same electronic health record rollout. It's a massive project. A lot of people tout that it's the largest of its kind in Canada or North America. And really what that comes down to is the sheer number of organizations involved. At three, it's significant. The number of facilities involved, there's well over 24 facilities going live, which is a mix of long-term care homes, acute facilities. There's hundreds of ambulatory clinics involved in the rollout. And then also just the sheer scale of the project. It started in 2013, and at any given time, it's kind of had a running staff total between 400 and 600 people. So it really is quite significant in scope and scale.
Like 400 to 600 people working on the project? Wow.
Yeah, at any given time. And that doesn't even include all of the subject matter experts and the consultants and physicians and staff that we bring in to help inform the design of the system.
Mm-hmm. I guess What drove the need for this project? Why did they want to do it? Were there pain points that they were recognizing or yeah?
Yeah, so BC has an interesting method of delivering care in that we have a lot of health organizations and authorities that have overlapping jurisdiction. So in this case, the CST project is comprised of Providence Healthcare, the organization that I now work for, Vancouver Coastal Health, and Provincial Health Services Authority. In many ways, these three health organizations operate in the same space. Both VCH and PHC serve the downtown east side. VCH offers a lot of community care in the same region that PHC operates. Provincial Health Services covers all of the ambulance care and specialty care in the province, so things like cancer care, as well as pediatric and maternity care. So there was a realization that there was a lot of value to be gained by bringing all of those organizations under the same system, such that information was available in real time, and that practices could be more easily standardized between these. You see that a lot in between a specialty site that delivers a very specific type of care, like cancer care, and a site that may only offer that as one of many services. By being on the same platform, it allows standardization to be shared between those two sites much easier.
So you're saying that someone living in a specific area in BC could be covered by all three of those healthcare like agencies or organizations? So you could be receiving care from all three?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, PHC and VCH both operate out of Vancouver proper as at least a majority of their services live there. PHSA services the entire province, so it covers everything from Prince George all the way down to Vancouver. But you can just kind of see how all three of those may be providing care to the same patients at the same time.
Same patient. And there's probably like this disconnect in terms of having flow of information or just having people aware of what was going on in the different facets of their health.
Absolutely. And in terms of the ability to share that information, you know, we've brought facilities live that previously were on paper. We've brought facilities live that were previously on fairly robust EHRs and others that were on this sort of like homebrew, built in-house EHR that fit their needs really well, but never really met the needs of other areas.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that it was difficult to get, because you said you got a lot of facilities, over 24, to come on board and have the same system. Would you say it was difficult to convince them to switch from their previous systems or even like get involved in this project?
Yeah, I mean, that's almost a loaded question. Of course, there's always people resistant to change. And if you think about the sort of willingness to change, you've always got the people that look at a paper system and go, you know, it's the year 2020 or 2021 rather. How are we still using paper? But then you also have the people that have known paper charting their entire life and are very resistant to moving to something electronic.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I guess I'm impressed in terms of how you got the buy-in of all of these sites, or they were just like involved in this project. Cause I know that it's really difficult, especially in busy areas to get people on board to switch up what they're currently doing. Cause it's a lot of work and a lot of learning of new things.
And I can't take a lot of credit for managing all of that change, for sure. I had a role to play in it, but with 600 staff and lots of ministry mandates as well, it's definitely a mixture of sort of soft touch and more forceful measures in terms of rolling this out. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I guess having more of an understanding of the project as a whole in terms of how it got started and the pain points and why there was a need for it. More specifically, I guess, what was your involvement in the project and where did that start first playing in, and why was your role needed?
Yeah, so I've had the good fortune of wearing many hats in the role, and even in my current role, I'm still very tangentially related to the project. So I started off as an analyst on the project, really working on the design and build of the system before it was ever implemented. So this is in the ramp up to customize an American system to be a Canadian solution. But from there, I transferred into this sort of implementation lead project manager role, which was a bit of everything, but it really involved us going to the first facility or set of facilities rather, and doing exactly what you said of making sure that the staff, leadership, physicians were all on board, trained, ready to go, and understood the system before the initial launch, which, given how long the design and build phase for the system was before even the first rollout, there was a lot of pressure on that first go live to be a success, given how much time, money, and effort had gone into the project.
So you were involved in, I guess, both phases, the first part of the designing and really customizing it to having that carried through and flow to the first site.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I've had the fortune of seeing it live through sort of sustainment and ongoing maintenance as well.
Mm-hmm. I guess let's dive, more into just your involvement in getting involved in the first site and what that looked like in terms of the first few stages. So we break it up into three, maybe the beginning of like project planning and trying to set that project up.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe we start by framing what that initial go live aimed to do, mm-hmm. which was to bring two acute facilities live and for scale, one fairly small community hospital. And then the other sort of a more significant community hospital in the Lower Mainland. So we're talking the bigger of the two was about 200-ish funded beds, as well as a number of sort of supporting services around it. So there's about 20 to 30 ambulatory clinics. There is a long-term care facility, a mental health dedicated facility coming up with that. Back to your question, in terms of the planning, really the first thing we realized, so we showed up on site about 6 months out from the go live mm-hmm. to start this process. And one of the first things we realized very quickly is that a community hospital like that hadn't in recent history or potentially ever gone through a project of this size, where effectively every service from food services to the physicians to the medicine ward all had to be aligned, all had to be ready at the same time, all had to buy into the project and know what each other were doing in this initiative. Mm-hmm. Where really a site like that was more familiar with, you know, rolling out a new practice standard in a single unit where you might have to deal with 100 staff, not several thousand.
No, they weren't used to, or I guess never had a project where everyone had to be on board or involved.
Yeah, definitely not like this. This was new to, honestly, new to everyone.
New to everyone, including yourselves. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. We were kind of learning together.
So I guess once you realized that or understood that a project like that hadn't ever been rolled out, how did you approach that? Or what was your first thought? Obviously, I guess for me, first thought would be that's intimidating. But how did you work through that?
Yeah. And again, like the scrutiny on this, I mean, we were always watching out for media and things like that coming through this go live because of the sort of scrutiny on the project. But working through it, I'd say the first thing that we had to establish was working with the unit managers and department managers to make sure that they knew everything that was happening in their area. And I think many of us, those that have been in working within hospitals as well as outside of them, would be surprised at how challenging of a task that is. Everybody has their reports to staff list, which typically consists of the nurses, the unit coordinators. Depending on the hospital, it might include some allied health services as well. They report directly into the manager. They usually have a pretty good sense of who those people are, what they do, how many of them there are. But then you think about all the other things that happen on an inpatient unit or in an outpatient service in terms of, groups like pharmacy and imaging and lab. You've got your physician colleagues that are coming in, obviously don't report into the manager as independent practitioners, but are still, absolutely integral to the care. So really that was the starting point is let's try and scope out exactly who and what is involved in each of these departments or units.
So did you, I completely agree with you on that point. I feel like you don't really understand the full nature of what someone's doing until they're gone from the system. And then you realize, oh, wait, all of these things that we thought were being covered or were there or were just happening are actually covered by this specific person. So I completely agree with you in terms of mapping out exactly what someone's doing and what their day-to-day looks like, especially in a hospital or clinic where things vary a lot. Building off of that, I guess I wanted to understand more of how that mapping took place, because if you're having to understand what every single role does and only have 6 months until you go live, how did that take place?
Yeah, I mean, it was a lot of collaborative conversations with the managers for sure. I'd say when trying to implement a system like this, especially when they're coming from paper where there aren't like system access roles, mm-hmm. I mean, there's these sort of practice guidelines where a nurse isn't signing off on a physician order sheet in a paper world. But there's nothing enforcing that. There's nothing stopping them from picking up a pen and signing it. In the new world, we actually need to set those sort of restriction guidelines around what an individual can do in the system. So I would say this initial mapping process was a lot of, let's get the first name, last name of everybody. Mm-hmm. Let's put down the sort of classification of role or their job description that they have in the HR system so that we can start to inform what sort of access and role this person may play in the unit. Obviously, a phlebotomist is a phlebotomist is a phlebotomist, and they do a certain set of tasks. From there, we'd look at what our access model in the system was and what position mapped most closely to those users. And again, because this was new, a lot of that came down to do Sally and Bob do a similar job? We should make sure they're in the same position. So it was more about sort of eliminating discrepancies and oddities than getting it perfect the first time.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like a good approach in terms of using more of like an agile methodology to test it out and make those big sample rules and then work towards like really customizing it and individualizing it and making sure that you have every aspect accounted for. I guess moving on from determining those roles and really understanding how like the organization's human resources are run, what came after that in terms of your role or for the project?
Yeah, so we used to sit in this room called the fishbowl during our time at the hospital. It was deemed that because of all the glass that was around, and it really sat sort of centrally in within the hospital so that everybody coming and going, coming on shift, coming off shift, typically passed by. And that led to a ton of foot traffic. So while we had this sort of formal role around making sure that everybody was getting the training that they needed and the onboarding that they needed, and that units were receiving all of the devices and hardware and infrastructure upgrades that were required to roll out the technology, we also played this more sort of informal change management role of being available to the staff, being available to the physicians, being available to the leaders for them to come in, ask questions, vent, often discuss concerns. It ended up being a bit of catch-all of sort of whatever was on people's minds, they would come in and ask us about. So, personally, that was a very fun and rewarding role for sure. And to your earlier point, I think it really helps you highlight and find those people that are going to be your sort of resistors versus your easy adopters. Mm-hmm. And we use some of that to our advantage to actually identify peer champions, often called super users in other projects, who would be able to help with the education on the unit in a more natural way. So these people were responsible for running workflow reviews, mm-hmm. where they would actually be teaching the staff what the system will look like within their day to day.
And be advocates for the system.
Absolutely.
So I guess your role was quite like hybrid in terms of not just project planning and keeping track of milestones, but also providing that two-way feedback or two-way line of communication with the staff at the hospital and at all the clinics?
Yeah, and I mean, to your point, even with the design of the positions, there was still feedback and requirements coming from people just dropping into our into our space and saying, I don't think that's going to work in the system. And even as we were getting close to go live, we'd still be feeding those requirements back to the technical team to make sure that they were considered or incorporated before the go live.
Did you like intend to be this fishbowl to begin with, or is it something that just kind of emerged during the project?
I think for anybody that's looked for sort of ad hoc space within a hospital that they can just squat in and use as an office, you'll know that it's typically whatever's available. So this was a great space because of all of those characteristics of it, being accessible and sort of on the main footpath. But at the same time, it was also just where we fit. So I don't know how much of it was intentional and how much of it was sort of circumstantial, but it worked out quite nicely.
Yeah, from the sounds of it, it really did, because I know for a lot of projects, like a huge success criteria in terms of going live and really making sure that you have everything captured in what people and employees do at the organization within the system. A lot of that is just from feedback that you get from people. Like, you can plan and design, but at the end of the day, they know how to do their jobs best, and every person's job slightly differs. So I think it was amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is one of the things I would say, whether it was circumstantial or intentional in the first go live, it was definitely intentional in the second go live. In fact, we went even crazier with the fishbowl.
Oh, wow.
In that we just had a glass room in the cafeteria at the second facility that we went live with. And that was huge for foot traffic, because anytime anybody was going on lunch break or going for a coffee, they would stop in and ask us questions. Got to the point where we were actually handing out free coffee cards for the cafeteria next door if people could come in and show us that they'd completed their training.
That's incredible.
It was very tactile.
Yeah, no. Yeah. Uh-huh.
A very tactile takeaway for any project that you're running in an acute facility is to think about where you're situating your staff and how you can make it accessible to the people that need to find you.
That is honestly incredible. I know you learn about it in theory, that you're supposed to have these two-way channels and really incorporating people's feedback and spending the time with them to map what their role is, and just making sure to always be receptive to their feedback is not something that gets done a lot, because it takes a lot of time, like addressing people's concerns. Exactly. You're looking at me like, it takes a lot of time, and obviously you have other items that you're responsible for to deliver, right? Like project planning, measuring KPIs.
Absolutely.
No, keep going.
I was gonna say absolutely. I mean, you know, it is very challenging. We'd be preparing a dashboard for executives at the same time that somebody's coming in and asking us, you know, how high does this workstation on wheels adjust up and down? And you're having to like table this very important, very deadline driven report that you're trying to prep with like working through ergonomics with somebody.
Yeah. I was just going to ask you in terms of how did you measure the project and keep track of that? Or what, I guess, more did that look like?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. So this is now going back to the first go live with that community hospital. After we'd sat down and done all of that position mapping work to figure out what access everybody was going to need, that then informed the next step of what training and prep they would need to do. So obviously somebody that's going to have just a very small, limited amount of access to the system doesn't require the same amount of training as a physician. We also had a multimodal training sort of method. So there was online training, in-person training, informal training, all sorts of modalities. So the reporting ended up being grouped by those units. Once we had a good understanding of everything that was happening in an area, we would use that as the basis for a sort of a reporting unit. So let's say we had a unit 3 West, for example, and they had a compilation of nurses, doctors, unit coordinators, and allied staff that are coming and going from their area. At a person-by-person level, we would be tracking their progress on different activities. Have they done 10 out of 12 of their online modules? Have they attended a classroom session? Did they pass a classroom session? Mm-hmm. All the way through this checklist. And then what that allowed us to do is report at three different levels, which I think is really important. Mm-hmm. The first is at the individual level, so that the manager knows who they need to follow up with to make sure that that person is ready to go. Mm-hmm. The second, still at the manager level, although sometimes at the director level, is across this whole unit, how are we doing? So, you know, on average, we've completed 70% of our mm-hmm. online learning in 3 West. And then the third level is at more of the executive director and above level, where we're saying the medicine program, which is several units across both facilities, the medicine program is at 70% of their e-learning completion, mm-hmm. so that the sort of COO for the community of care was able to look at it and say, mental health is ahead of schedule, medicine's behind schedule, ambulatory is on track, and focus their attention accordingly.
Wow. That is incredible.
It was a lot of Excel's, PowerPoints,
yeah.
manual adjustments.
No, it sounds like a very detailed and strategic approach. Like everything was accounted for, or everything that you could account for was there. And that I really like that way you described it in terms of how it built up in order to, I guess, understand the progress of a project as a whole. Because I think what's difficult is, if it's a small project, you can just ask someone, oh, like, how are you doing? How are you feeling? Let me see your checklist. Okay. And then report it. Right. But when you really make it big and there are a lot of people involved, it can get difficult to just understand where is everyone at or how is this working as a whole? So.
Yeah. And if I can add on to that, when you've got something that's got a 6-month implementation run up, you have to account for the fact that people are going to leave, join, change, transfer.
Oh, yeah.
More often than not, I mean, right up until the wire, we were dealing with putting people on leave so that we didn't have to worry about them in the global report, adding people to lists because they were new hires or they'd recently transferred from another unit. So it was really important that we had that very granular level of detail, mm-hmm. such that if the COO ever wanted to say, okay, medicine's really behind now, can we see what's going on? We were actually able to drill down to the appropriate
level. Wow. I didn't even account for people coming and leaving. I think that happens all the time, especially in the world of COVID and healthcare in hospitals and clinics. So, wow, that I'm impressed. I've never seen a project run that big, but it sounds like you did your due, or everybody involved in the project did the due diligence of taking something that's really big and breaking it down into something small to in order to track it and understand the health of it. So,
yeah. And one other comment, because you said sometimes on a smaller project, you can just kind of get a temperature check on mm-hmm. it was funny because after all of this reporting and all this work that went into these things, our true go, no go was informed by that, but ultimately we had to have the manager say yes or no, I'm ready to go. Mm-hmm. But because we'd put them through all of this scrutiny and testing to make sure that they understood every detail about their unit, the sort of confidence that leadership had when the manager said, yes, I am ready, even if the numbers looked bad or if they looked great, they felt confident that person knew mm-hmm. enough to make that claim.
So it still did involve like the human aspect of just checking in with them.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's interesting and important to keep in mind.
Yeah.
I guess once all the trainings were completed and you had that ready to go from everybody in the project, how did go live and stabilization, I guess, like the weeks after go live look like? For the project?
Yeah, I mean, in short, chaos.
That's every goal life.
I was going to say, and I hear it was a relatively smooth one, too. I think if you don't have a little bit of chaos at goal life, something's wrong. People aren't asking, like, people don't understand it enough to ask the hard questions. In my experience, the true measure is how quickly do people get to the hard questions? Because on day one, the questions are like, how do I sign in? And that's an easy fix. But if by week two, you're still getting, how do I sign in? That's a problem. Mm-hmm. But if by week two, you're getting, hey, actually, this isn't working for how we do our job. Those are the sorts of questions you really want to get to early on. So our go live, massive cutover event, kind of leading up to the, or in the weeks before, and thinking about how we move paper charts into the electronic system such that there's still that continuity of care for these patients was a huge undertaking for sure. And then from go live on, I mean, 24/7 support for sure. You think about that mass of, you know, 400 to 600 people from the project being physically on site. This is all before COVID. So they're physically on site. The site is just drowning. We're flying in consultants from the US. Yeah. It was packed. You couldn't go 10 feet without tripping over somebody that was there strictly to help you use the system. So I like, kudos to the organization for backing it so strongly. And it's not cheap to do that sort of level of support, but it was really integral to the success of the project. So
I really like the way you phrased that at the beginning in terms of temperature checking, just how go live is going. I completely agree with you in the sense that having those basic questions still be a problem weeks after go live shows that perhaps maybe the prep that you did beforehand, before going live, wasn't ideal or didn't work out the way you thought it did. But I'm glad to hear that wasn't the case for you and for this project, and just impressed with the sheer amount of support that was within the go live and stabilization.
My favorite plug, I always liked it. So I've been through two of these massive go lives now, the first one that we've been discussing, and then I came over to Providence Healthcare and supported theirs as well, which was roughly double in scale. Wow. I know, but we had all the lessons learned from the previous one, right? So bigger, but easier at the same time. The thing that they did that I think is super novel, and a lesson to take away to other projects unrelated to EHR rollouts, was they put a significant amount of backing on what they called the go live cart. So at the first implementation, they had the candy cart, which was like, you know, just a bucket of Twizzlers and M&Ms and things that people could grab. And leadership was rolling it around so that they could get that sort of informal conversation going with the staff on the units. And that was really well received. So they really doubled down on the second one. And for the first 10 days, they were providing, I think it was like 3 times daily of a snack cart for the day shift staff. And then once a night, they would provide Subway. And it was always leadership, people from the project, and people that needed to hear the feedback to be able to action it, that would be going around with these carts. Staff were obviously excited to see them. Free food's always welcome. But that's how we got so much of the informal feedback. And at 3 a.m., you're getting no good feedback unless people are energized or ready to engage. So it was a big risk. It was a lot of money, but it really paid dividends in terms of,
because then you get people approaching you, right? I think one really hard thing to do is that clinicians have so much to do. Like, this is not their priority at all. It's their patient's health. And asking for that feedback, they're not going to come to you. They have a lot to do. So providing this as an incentive or just as an avenue to have a conversation and also, you know, help them with their day, reward them, thank you for dealing with us for these months, is a great way to just get them there and see their face and have those conversations.
Absolutely.
Wow, that's incredible. I got to take that one away. Everybody listening, taking notes right now, if you have the budget to do it, obviously. And I like how it was leadership who did it too. Like, you could have put anyone there, but having leadership there shows them how they value, like, the time of the people who are in this project or have to be in this project, and just make them approachable, right? Sometimes it's hard talking to someone who's so much higher than you, or you know that there's this title slapped onto them, but having them there doing something fun like that, or rewarding them, it's amazing.
Yeah, and who can say, like, I remember the first night of our second go live, I was on with the vice president of research for Providence Healthcare, and him and I were pushing around Subway sandwiches for people to eat. I mean, who can say that they've ever worked a night shift and seen the VP of research come around and check in on how they're doing? It's very cool.
You're making me hungry now. But honestly, that is a sweet lesson to take away. I wanted to touch on this project is still going on, right? Like 9 years later, we're still rolling out some more sites, or last couple of sites.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the project's general roadmap, was, in my mind at least, was let's hit a community facility first, make sure we can land it at this sort of 200-ish bed range. Then it was to this next more academic site, see if we can land it at more of the 500 bed range. Then it's hit this sort of multi-track approach where it's doing both specialty services, so things like cancer care, children's and women's, which is our pediatric and maternity specialty hospitals, and heading into the most significant go live, which again, in terms of scale, is kind of like double from the last one. So now we're talking closer to the 1,000 inpatient bed range. So it's continuing to snowball, it's continuing to pick up momentum and facilities as it goes. And I think the more sites that are live, the more sort of backing it has to continue forward.
So since you're my KPI person, with all the Excel sheets and PowerPoints, I guess, tell me where we're at in terms of the project now. Like how many sites are left, and which ones are in progress? Not sure if you know, but how many are left if you had to guess?
Yeah, top of mind. I mean, it depends on what you define as a mm-hmm. facility. From a technical standpoint, a facility in the system is an ambulatory clinic or an entire hospital, and those are both facilities in the system. Obviously not the same mm-hmm. scale. I would say, as sort of ballpark understanding, we're probably about halfway through the acute beds that are still to go. So there's a few more community hospitals mm-hmm. to do, as well as that massive 1,000-bed hospital, which is significant. And then on the ambulatory front, I would almost say we've just begun. If anybody ever wants to shape their career mm-hmm. in informatics, become an expert in informatics in the ambulatory setting. Not only is outpatient care, I feel, the future of healthcare, from sort of a disease prevention and avoidance perspective, but also from a systems perspective, wow, is it ever complex. Yes. Every acute facility we bring live at this point brings with it 100 to 200 or 300 ambulatory clinics, which each needs to be considered, analyzed, designed, tested and implemented individually. So that is really going to be ongoing for the foreseeable future.
Wow. I did not know that. Why would you say that like ambulatory clinics are so complex, or there's just a lot more to be done in terms of specifications compared to some of the other units and sites?
At least from my experience, ambulatory care seems to have fairly simple clinical workflows. Typically what's happened clinically is within sort of a box. You know, they might do some procedures, they might do some minor unique medication pieces, but it's fairly controlled when you compare it to an inpatient space. Where ambulatory clinics get incredibly complicated is in a lot of the sort of like flow pieces. So how are you managing referrals? How are you triaging your patients to make sure that your wait list is managed appropriately? How are you managing schedules of a physician that works here one afternoon a week and has the rest of their calendar in an Outlook calendar somewhere else? there's just a lot of sort of logistics challenges that you run into in outpatient spaces that you don't see in inpatient, where you know it's just 24/7 service. Hmm.
That's interesting. I definitely want to look more into that, because I never realized there was that much of a difference. And it makes sense, because you're getting people, like, that's the first point of contact in a hospital for a lot of the times. And you're getting people from all different sources. Like, you could get someone walking in with their mom or dad. You could get an ambulance coming in, which are paramedics and people who already know what's going on with the patient. So I guess it's just the variety of what's going on.
Absolutely. And then just everything is unique in the ambulatory setting. There's a lot less policy and guideline around what can and can't happen in that space. And it's newer, right? Inpatient care is bread and butter. Everybody knows what a hospital is and does. Not everyone's clear on what can and can't happen in an outpatient setting.
And even just, I guess, like, where the patient goes next, right? Once you get them into a hospital and they're getting seen for something, you know, like, the outcome's going to be like either A, B, or C, and you know where A, B, or C leads. But in an ambulatory clinic, you're kind of still trying to determine, well, where is this person best placed? And there could be so many options, not just A, B, and C. It's a lot. And that decision-making probably differs by person to person too. So.
Absolutely. And lifetime relationships, you know, nobody spends their entire life in a hospital. But some people do spend their entire life connected to an ambulatory clinic. So that sort of longitudinal care is very unique to that setting.
You've gotten me interested. I'm going to have to do some more reading on this, because it's definitely something that was never brought to my attention, or just this uniqueness I've never really heard of, but definitely am interested. I know you're not the expert, but you did provide some valuable insight. Yeah, I'm looking more into diving into it. Yeah.
That's great. Yeah, I only know enough to be dangerous in that area.
To only be what?
To be dangerous.
No, I think you provided some interesting tidbits for this setting. Yeah. So now that we know, I guess, the future of the project and how it's still going on and where it's at, I guess one of my favorite questions to ask on the podcast is, what does the future look like for you? Where do your passions lie? And what are you doing right now, since I know you're not involved in this project anymore?
Yeah, so I had the opportunity to stay on with Province Healthcare after we implemented there, and manage the clinical informatics team at Providence, who's really, we're sort of the, like, stay behind after the project goes live. So, you know, there's 600 people on the project. Obviously, they don't all stay at the facility, but there is this sort of smaller cohort, and we kind of spoke about, you know, kind of between 20 and 30 people who continue to maintain, fix, optimize the system, as well as do really cool stuff like utilize the data that comes out of the system. Quite often the project has nothing to do with that. They implement it and they say, you're going to be able to access data. Have fun. But it's our team that actually gets the opportunity to start to do that. So how do we look at quality initiatives and research in a different way now that we can easily go through thousands of records in the time that it would have taken us to go through five in the paper world? So that's where I am now, and I'm very happy and excited by it. We get lots of opportunities to do cool stuff with data, the system, new applications, and figure out how we integrate new functionalities, and we really get this close relationship with the clinicians in the hospital.
That sounds incredible and honestly really exciting. I think everything that you're saying resonated with me, or I just understood it in the sense that data analytics and, like, using the information that you get from a system is something that definitely normally happens after a go live, because there's so much emphasis on just having people understand the system. So it's really cool you get to work on making the system even better, keeping it up to date, and just having it fit for the organization the best it can. Are you still the fishbowl? Do people still come to you about, oh, you know, I want to make this system like AI or predict, let's put some predictive analytics in there. Can a robot do it now?
That's my biggest regret is we lost our fishbowl. We got moved to, in fact, we're actually in the original St. Paul's Hospital, which is, I believe, the oldest healthcare facility in BC. I could be wrong on that, but it was built in 1892. At least the oldest that's still standing. We're in the old nursing school. So it's very cool. Our offices are old dormitories. And every once in a while, you'll go into a room and find that the back room connects to a washroom or a closet or some artifact of its previous use. So not as visible to the staff, unfortunately, but in sort of COVID requirements, anyhow, most of that sort of informal conversation is happening over virtual communication.
I know we didn't even touch on how COVID probably affected the rollout of sites and just the maintenance of systems. That's a whole nother episode on its own. Yeah, but thank you so much for taking the time to discuss today. You are my first West Coast guest, and I found it so exciting learning about a system that, or just learning about how things are done over there. I think a lot of my training or just the information I know, especially because you live in your area, right? You learn about your local healthcare system. So I'm really glad to have brought some representation or have you represent the West Coast. So that's a big title to put to you. I'll definitely get some more West Coast people, but thank you for being the first. Yeah.
Happy to be the first, and thanks for having me on.
Always.
It's been great.
All right. So for more information on the project discussed today, check out the link in the description box of this episode. And that concludes our episode for today. Before we go, I'd like to say a special thank you to our listeners for tuning in to Hello Health Informatics. If you have any suggestions of who you'd like to hear next on the podcast, please send us an email in the link in the description box below. And I'll see you next episode.